Hello again, and welcome to another episode of the Global Exchange on the CJAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. Today we talk about Israel and Palestine with Peter Larson, Rick Kohler, Gerald Wright, and Margaret Ford. Peter teaches at Carleton University and is one of Canada's experts on Palestinian issues. Rick, Jerry, and Margaret all served in the Government of Canada with deep involvement in foreign affairs. Peter, Rick, Jerry, and Margaret, welcome to the Global Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
For listeners, Rick, Jerry, and Margaret recently participated in a tour of Palestine and Israel that Peter has been leading for many years. Last year, I was a participant. This year included stays in Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Nazareth, Nev Shalom, Tel Aviv, a visit to Yad Vashem, and meetings with Palestinians. They toured by bus up and down Israel and out of the West Bank and through zones A, B, and C. They met with members of our embassy, representatives of the Knesset, and of course the PLO, as well as many members of civic society representing differing points of view. Their trip took place against continuing turmoil in the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, as well as between Sunni and Shiite, Arab and Persian, Israeli and Palestinian. There is also continuing political instability in Israel, where it appears likely that we're going to see a third round of elections in less than a year. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cannot form a majority government because he has been unable to increase his bloc of 55, while blue and white leader Benny Gantz cannot form Arab government because he too has been able to find the necessary support from the joint list, and a majority of the Jewish population consider this to be quite important for them to be able to figure this out. A national unity government cannot be formed, and so it looks like there'll be a new election. Meanwhile, there is no expectation that a long-awaited U.S. peace initiative will now materialize, and there's growing pressure that the European Union should step up its own diplomacy to broker talks. Israeli leadership has increasingly been signaling its willingness to move towards annexation of the occupied territories, and the Trump administration announcement last month, in a break with international law, that Israeli settlements would no longer be considered illegal. The Trump administration's, of course, recognition of Jerusalem as the country's capital are also encouraging Israeli hardliners. So that's a bit of the backdrop. Peter, why don't you start us off by telling us how and why you came to organize these trips?
Well, thanks, Colin. Yeah, I did start organizing these trips about 8 years ago. It was after I took a trip there myself. For a long time, I'd been puzzled with competing sympathies on the Israel-Palestine issue. I felt that the Palestinians were being very badly done by, but I also felt the Jewish need security, and I went and on my first trip there, my ideas started to become clearer, and I realized that, and I think this is true almost anywhere you travel, when you get somewhere, you realize things are more complicated than you thought. My going-in idea that Palestinians live over here and the Jews live over here, and really this is all just about working out a border. And when you get there, you realize the issues are somewhat more, if quite a bit more complicated than that. And so I started to take people with me, and mostly people have really enjoyed it and come back saying, I've learned a lot that I didn't understand, and that's what motivates me to do it from year to year.
All right. Well, let me now turn to the participants this year. And Margaret, why don't you start off? And then I'll move to Jerry and Rick. Margaret, you start off about your impressions and observations on Palestine and Israel, your takeaways.
Well, I came back very pessimistic. I didn't think there were any easy answers to Palestinians and Israelis living together in a helpful way, in a wholesome way. I came away with a feeling that there was no easy answer to how you could resolve the conflict in Palestine and Israel. The two-state solution no longer seems possible, in part because there's no physical second state. Israel has taken over much of the territory, and what Palestinians now hold as land are the more populous built-up areas. There are also a large number of Israeli settlements in the occupied territories, and it would be very hard to reverse this situation. Now, a one-state solution, prima facie, would seem more attractive, but it has one tragic flaw in my view. Under a one state with Palestinians included, Israel would no longer be a Jewish state, and this is an almost deep-seated need for many Jews to have a Jewish state where they can feel safe and secure. Last but not least, the current through incrementalist policy position suits the Israelis. They can endure what they can carry on with what they're doing and not feel any need to negotiate with the Palestinians at this time.
Rick, what would you add to what Margaret said, or what was your takeaways?
Well, sure. I would like to add that. I had the opportunity during my professional career to travel to Tel Aviv and Jerusalem on business over years, And I had, like most Canadians or most folks who don't live in the area, a general idea that there was conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, but I didn't have a lot of intellectual understanding of how complex it is. This opportunity accomplished after I had taken the course from Professor Larson at Carleton University to quench a little more the thirst I had to understand the situation better. Now, of course, one understands after the 2 millennia that have gone by since this relationship began way back in the history of time, the more recent in the past century Holocaust in Europe during the Second World War, one easily recognizes the logic of having a home for called Israel for sanctuary and safety for Jews. But at the same time, when it was created in 1948 by the United Nations, what was carved out as a fair share for the Palestinians remains nebulous. And I think, just to summarize for now, my experience is that we had an opportunity to meet many non-governmental organizations, activists, Palestinian refugees. We talked with a lot of people. We also met with the other representative of the other sides, settlers and Israeli diplomats and so on. And all of us got a much better understanding of how deep the complexities are, but also a realization, at least in my case, that there's a human rights challenge of major proportions here. And I'll maybe build on this after Jerry has spoken a bit, but despite the pessimism that Margaret shared, philosophically, I'm more optimistic for the long term. It may not be in my personal lifetime, but I really am optimistic that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
I wish you a long life there.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that, Rick. But Jerry, please, I'm interested in your takeaways.
Well, I came away with a much more graphic understanding of what the right of return meant and how much it meant to Palestinians. The elderly gentleman who had been a native of one of the villages raised to make possible the Canada Park in the occupied territories said to us, "My one hope before I die is to be able to return to this particular part of my country and live here." That was a hopelessly unrealistic aspiration, but boy, it sure spoke of the depth of emotional feeling on that subject. Secondly, I thought that the investment that Israel has made in keeping the Palestinians in a permanent state of frustration, as Hannah Nashrawi told us, we're fragmented by checkpoints. That investment bespeaks a deep, deep concern about the security of their situation and the military dimension, which we really didn't get a chance to go into, but which I think has to be properly explored before we can get a balanced understanding of the situation. Finally, I agree with the others with the pessimism that's already been expressed. I was particularly, I guess I was particularly shaken by the attitudes of the young Palestinians we met. We met some very attractive teenage Palestinians who were, were inured to the conflict, were incapable. They'd never met Israelis. They were incapable of seeing beyond it. And I felt what we're really doing is socializing these people into a state of permanent conflict. And I see the only hope, therefore, in some kind of external event which will force the major participants, the major governments, to recalculate their advantages and just think outside the box in a way that isn't being done right now.
Okay, before I come back to the human rights issue that Rick raised, Peter, you've been doing this now for a number of years. What stood out this year that was different from previous trips?
I guess there were two things, Colin, that struck me. One is in the wake, I'm attributing causality here, but in the wake of the Trump administration decisions about Jerusalem being recognized as the capital of Israel, moving the embassy there, even the most recent declaration that was made while we were there that the United States would recognize the settlements that Canada and the international community calls illegal, that they would recognize them as legal. The settlers seem to have the wind in their sails. We saw in Hebron, we heard stories in Nablus about how the settlers are penned into refugee camps surrounded by people. We saw that in Hebron as well. So there seems that there was a kind of triumphalism, Israeli Zionist side, that I hadn't seen before. We heard at the Office of the Commissioner of Human Rights, UN Commissioner of Human Rights, saying that the rate of house demolitions of Palestinian houses in Jerusalem has increased very dramatically in the last year. On the other side, so that's on one thing that's changed on the Israeli or Jewish or Zionist side. On the other side, I was struck by the fact that compared to previous years, the young Palestinians we were talking to were not the peace negotiations or the two-state solution. They were talking to us more frequently about equality and human rights. And while they were probably in disagreement with each other and maybe didn't even know each other, young Palestinians we met in Jaffa, in Hebron, in Ramallah, and so on, were starting to speak the same language, which is closer to our Western kind of language of human rights, equality, and democracy.
So, Peter, what you're saying is that human rights are now seen as part of a broader democratic framework. But as I think several of you have noted, that would sort of defy, if you end up with a one-state solution, then it defies the whole principle of a Jewish state, does it not?
It does indeed. You know, and Colin, you and I have talked about this before. I think that Jews absolutely need and deserve protection, but I do not think now that the idea of protecting Jews by creating a Jewish state in which Jews have more rights than others is going to work. I think that's a wrong idea. I don't think it can work. It will not bring protection to Jews. It will bring perpetual conflict. That's not my call, but that's my observation.
Sure. No, let me ask, because this really gets to the nub of the issue. Margaret, what do you think on sort of the human rights and the whole idea of the one state, which I you know, this is a real conundrum. What would be yours? And then I'll ask Jerry and Rick their perspective on this.
On the human rights.
Yeah, the human rights and the whole idea of the sort of that, you know, I think you were fairly pessimistic, but maybe I misread you.
No, I am fairly pessimistic, and I'm particularly pessimistic about the human rights situation. The number of administrative detentions that Israel has every year, and several thousand, these people live in just the utmost inhumane situations. They're separated, they're beaten, they're psychologically vulnerable, and people can be in solitary confinement for months on end before charges are even laid. And having to sign confessions that they don't really understand because they're in Hebrew and so on. One feels that the way Israel handles difficult situations in the West Bank is completely contrary to international law and international law conventions, and that this is an area where really Canada and others should put increasing pressure on Israel to change its human rights situation. In other areas like housing, again, Israel continues to demolish houses and take them back whenever they cannot show that they have proper land registration. And in the past, land registration was really done through an oral knowledge rather than any kind of land registry. So many Palestinians live in homes which have no legal title to their property. So this is also a really difficult human rights situation.
Rick and Jerry, come away on the human rights front?
Well, let me just jump in there. I had laid down a marker that, unlike Jerry and Margaret, I'm a little bit more long-term optimistic. But one thing I wanted to throw in first is that we Canadians need to continually remind ourselves of the similarities that evolve when one examines this situation with Canada's own internal relationship with its First Nations. And if ever Canada has newer opportunities to contribute to assisting in the peace process in the Middle East, we have a lot of experience in land treaties that remain unresolved to draw on. Why I was a little optimistic, when you look at the backdrop of the human rights challenges, the lack of freedom for most Palestinians to travel, the lack of freedom they have to pursue their professions outside of the small, tiny area where one of their various forms of citizenship limit them. The fact of Gaza, which remains a kind of sore on the planet as a large open-air prison, these are challenges that, choir address. And yet I, like Jerry, was so impressed with the young Palestinians that we met. They were talking about equality. They were talking about human rights. They were not talking about revenge and anger and aggression. We heard from them this open recognition that they, like Canadians, realize that Europeans are here to stay in Canada. They're not going to return to Europe. That the Jews, who are settled and settled by UN resolution, are there to stay, and they recognize the rightness of that. What they wish to do is to participate in a peace process that would allow them justice, some form of equal opportunity with their neighbors. And the last thing I want to throw in here is that if one thinks this is impossible, you just have to look back to major civil challenges that the world has experienced in the past. The Berlin Wall came down all of a sudden. South Africa became a new space on Earth. And here, if you look at the actual Jews who live within Israel today, there's anecdotally at least 15% who believe that something better needs to be accomplished on behalf of Palestinians. This includes journalists, and it includes even an Israeli retired diplomat that we met who retired in protest from the Israeli Foreign Service. You look at demographics, you look at pressure from the outside, and you look at the actual luxury for Jews living in Israel to aspire to living in peace and security in an arrangement that gives them the comfort of not having to worry about defending themselves legitimately.
It's true.
So, go ahead, Jerry.
Can I come in? It's true. Yes. We didn't meet a single Palestinian who expressed hatred for Israelis. And there were spokespersons that we encountered who were definitely of a very liberal frame of mind and I think thought beyond the immediate concerns of the Israeli government. But I find it hard to believe that there is an expanding constituency for human rights in Israel. And I think that the public opinion polling bears that out. I think it would have to go a lot higher than 15% before I'd feel that there really was hope on the horizon. As Gideon Levy, columnist for Aretz, told us, Israel is not a democracy, and there's no hope from change from within. Life is just too good in Israel. And I must say, in the Israelis that I met before we went on our tour, seemed quite oblivious to what was going on in the occupied territories.
Right. I guess I'd sort of, the Israel is not a democracy. It may not be perfect democracy, but they do have democratic elections.
Well, I think, let me just jump in there just for a moment. And it was Gideon Haaretz who really underlined that fact. He said, Israel is not a democracy. If you have a military regime controlling day-to-day life in occupied territories, you can't have that in parallel with a democracy.
I see. So there's a nuance there.
An important one, I think.
Yes. Yeah. So I guess I'd ask the three of you, because you've all come, and I know Peter's been many times. Do you think there is resolution? I know, Margaret, you're pessimistic. Rick, you're slightly more optimistic. Jerry, I think you're somewhere in between. Did you see, I'm impressed by your observations of the younger Palestinians who looked at things in a different way, but did you come away feeling that maybe this could, I know, Rick, you seem to think, yes, there may be opportunities for resolution, and I think you're drawing on the Canadian example of what we're trying to do, reconciling with First Nations and land claims may well offer some opportunities.
Well,
I'm in my
mid-70s now, so I've become a little more philosophical. And when I say I'm optimistic, I really meant it when I said affectionately that it won't be in my lifetime. I see, you know, some kind of success to be aspired to in 10, 15, 20, 30 years. But I do see a convergence of forces coming together amongst Israelis themselves, but also outside pressures. You take the position of the former leader of the United States, Obama. I think his sense of addressing the human rights challenges was much more sharp than the current administration, but lacked the resources to demonstrate the leadership that would be required as an honest broker to join with Western Europeans and bring the two parties, Palestinians and Israelis, together to negotiate hardcore. When that does happen, though, I believe that the raw material for success really genuinely is there.
I think it's going to take more than advocacy. I think it's going to take some external event. much as the Gulf War caused Prime Minister Rabin to think very hard about how he had to establish more less hostile relations with his immediate neighbors. I think that's the kind of thing that will do it. The other thing that might do it that is internal would be a realization of their demographic situation as the Palestinians multiply and begin to outnumber the Israelis in that region. And it's possible that there could be some change in the international environment. China and Russia are both very much prepared to move in that region if the United States withdraws, as it seems to be doing. So that's where I would put, if I have any hope, that's where I would put my hope in some major development that is going to radically change the calculation of advantages on the part of the major actors.
Margaret, what do you think?
I find it very difficult to know what would need to happen. I think you definitely need new leadership from all sides, Israeli, Palestinian, and especially the Americans. It's clear that this current U.S. government will not put the pressure on Israel, and they have such a large developmental military trade relationship with Israel that they're about the only country that can really bring or help push Israel to the table. The low-level conflict that's happening with Palestinians inside Israel, to me, means that the Israelis will not have to negotiate with the Palestinians. I mean, they're in a place now where they can basically ignore the Palestinian situation and just carry on as they are. So I think you would definitely need new leadership from the Americans to make a difference here. And I know a lot of people say the Americans are basically dealing themselves out of the picture. But again, if we look over the medium to longer term, I think you're going to have the Americans back in the picture if you're to bring the Palestinians and Israelis to a negotiating table.
All right. My last question.
I also hope that the EU might play a stronger role.
Yeah, my last question, which would take us back, because we've all made reference to Canada, and I'll start with you, Margaret, and go through. Can Canada help? And if so, what more should we be doing?
Well, we're not a major player, but we could be a supporting actor here. One of the important things I think we can do is to keep the conflict on the table so that people do not ignore it. And in international fora and elsewhere, we recently changed a vote at the UN on the Palestinians' right to self-determination and support for a two-state solution. We went from a no vote to a yes vote. And I think things like that are encouraging to see if we can, again, bring the Israelis to the table to really actually work for change in their policies. I would hope we could work with the EU and other like-minded countries to see if there are any openings, and when there are, to be able to take advantage of them. As a PLO representative said to us, they said they can stay the course, that they're going to be there, and that just staying the course is, in fact, an important function in not being ignored, not lowering the level of internal resistance to Israel. I think possibly increased Canadian aid would be another useful step. UNRWA has been defunded by the United States, and I think we need to step up our financing to support Palestinian refugees and also work with other UN organizations like UNICEF and the UN Development Program. We've done some work in Canada, has done some work in the justice governance sector, and I think that's also very important work to carry on, and that would make sure that Palestinians were ready to come to power. And I would hope in the short to medium term, we would be able to work with other like-minded countries to improve the human rights situation in the Palestinian territories.
Well, thank you. Underlining the importance of multilateralism and helpful fixing. Rick, you've talked about some of the things that Canada is doing. You mentioned reconciling First Nations. What else do you think Canada could do to be helpful?
Well, I very much parallel what Margaret has just shared. I think everything Margaret has said, I share, that we Canadians are modest players in this game. But advocacy is one of the things we can do. We can do well. We can draw on a wealth of experience, not only from our internal experience with our own First Nations, Inuit, and Métis challenges, but also on the experience that many of our Arabic experts in the Department of GAC, Global Affairs Canada, had transacted 15 years ago. And finally, if there were more courses offered in academia, like Peter Larson's course on Israel-Palestine, Is There a Solution?, having our academic institutions build a case for studying human rights and raise the level of awareness across our country of these challenges, I think all of these would contribute to what Canada can do in its own modest way to contribute to forward movement.
All right, good suggestions. Jerry?
I think the problem that I identified was, was the lack of information on both sides. And as I said, that they're, in particular, that the Israelis are oblivious to what's going on in the West Bank. I think that anything that involves any kind of device that involves bringing them to terms with the arguments and the case made by the other side is helpful. But that's a fairly minor point. In general, I think we have to give an example of respect for human rights, of civilized living among countries, and that is the best that we can do. And I think that to think that we could play a much more significant role is probably naive.
No, fair point. Peter, now I know you've made a number of suggestions. What would you summarize them in this, your top three. What would you suggest to the government of Canada and our new government?
Well, Colin, first of all, even if you were prime minister and I was minister of foreign affairs, there isn't a whole lot Canada can do. We're a long ways away. We're a small country. We have to be modest. However, I think that Canada really has two policies with respect to the Israel-Palestine situation. We have some statements on our website, which are, I think, overall quite supportable. But I think our actual actions on the ground do not fall. For example, we say that we're against the occupation, but when Israel builds new settlements and so on, we don't say anything. We say that we're for equality, but we learned when we were visiting our mission in Tel Aviv, the whole issue of the inequality of facing the Palestinian citizens of Israel was not on the radar screen of our mission in Tel Aviv. We say that we're for a just solution for the refugees, but in practice, we ignore it. So I think Canada could help if we put into practice what we say that we support on our
okay, so it's sort of, as you would put it, sort of walk the talk that is there, given that, again, as we all acknowledge, very complicated situation, but necessary to keep dealing with it. All right, well, look, I'll start with you, Peter, on this one. For listeners who want to know about Israel and Palestine and what's going on, and you, Professor Larson, have teach the course on this, which I know would get endorsed by everyone on this podcast, but what would you recommend if they were to read a book or two? And I'm going to ask each of you this because I think that for those who want to know more, this is always a popular part of the podcast, is further reading.
Thanks, Colin. The book I always recommend to everybody who takes my course is one called The Lemon Tree. It's by an American Catholic from California. It's a house that Jewish immigrant refugee from Bulgaria moves into, and she discovers later on that it actually was somebody's house. And that somebody turns up at her door one day, and they have a very interesting relationship, not a romantic relationship, but it explores the relationship with this whole question of the Jews seeking safety, Palestinians being driven from their homes, and how are you going to reconcile that? It's a very touching book that looks at this issue from both sides.
Well, the other book I would recommend. I concur with that. It is quite poignant, but go ahead, Peter, your next one.
So the other book is called Bible and Sword, or The Bible and the Sword, and it's by a very famous American author by the name of Barbara Tuchman, that many people will know from The Guns of August. Barbara Tuchman's father was a president of the American Jewish Federation. She traces the 1,000-year history of the link between the United Kingdom, Britain, and Palestine. And the subtitle of the book, I think, has to do with Lord Balfour, and explains in some detail how it is that Britain came to decide that it wanted to support the creation of a Jewish state at the end of World War I. A fascinating book, and one that I really enjoyed reading.
Excellent. Jerry, what would you recommend?
Well, I read and thoroughly enjoyed a book I think you've read too, Colin, called Jerusalem, A Biography by Simon Sebag Montefiore. And I read it, the way I read it, it did not impress me with the heavy weight that history imposes on this issue, making it impossible for people to get away from their prejudices. On the contrary, what it showed me was that there are really enormous possibilities here, because enmity between different peoples, particularly Palestinians and Israelis, but going back to much farther in history, to a range of peoples who have at various times occupied the Middle East, this region, enmity is not sort of firmly rooted in their psyches, that at times they've got along very well and cooperated very well. And I came away from that book with a real message of hope.
Oh, I agree with you on that. And I certainly, again, I recommend it because it's very well written, and it's like a good novel as you go along the stories he tells it. I concur with that very much, Jerry. Rick, what about you? What would you recommend people read?
Well, my thunder has been stolen because both the Lemon Tree and Montefiore's Jerusalem were the two at the top of my list. So clearly that's an endorsement. In the sense, or from a perspective of multimedia, something I would recommend, it's quite accessible, is a four-part series produced on video by the BBC called The Promise. It has the wonderful actress Claire Foy in it, who starred in the more recent The Crown, and it gives an extremely lush and detailed aperçu into the conflict, really, going back to the First World War and going forward into the Second. And if one wants to get a better understanding of the dynamics that are at play between these two great peoples, it would be an excellent source called The Promise, available on YouTube.
Perfect. Thank you. Margaret?
Well, I certainly don't have anything to add after hearing the three previous suggestions. I would just say how much I enjoyed reading The Lemon Tree, how it really made you feel that you were walking in the footsteps of what a Arab and an Israeli Jew would have both been through on both their sides. So let me just say I give that another accolade.
All right. Listeners now have great choice of books, as well as a go to YouTube to watch that docudrama, in a sense. Thanks very much, and thanks for listening tuning into this episode of The Global Exchange, part of the CJA Global Podcast Network. Our guests today were Peter Larson, Rick Kohler, Gerald Wright, and Margaret Ford. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating in iTunes. You can find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and that's where you'll find the book recommendations as well for guests. The CJAI Podcast Network is brought to you by our team at CJAI in Ottawa, and thanks go out to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.